This is KWAI, Honolulu, 1080 on the AM dial.
Fish lovers of Hawaii, listen up, please, because there's some good news and some bad news. The bad news is that the state and federal governments have closed the main Hawaiian Islands fisheries for 7 bottom fish species. This closure affects the so-called Deep Seven, meaning Opakapaka, Kalikali, Onaga, Ehu, Jindai, Sea Bass, and Lehi. So from now until September 1st, you can't catch them, eat them, give them away, or even have one on your boat. The good news is that the Deep Seven fisheries of the northwestern Hawaiian Islands are loaded with fish and are open year-round. Not too many boats are allowed to fish the northwest these days, but you can ask your favorite fish store or restaurant to keep an eye out for you when their catches do arrive at the fish auction. So good luck and bon appetit!
Welcome to the Carol Cox Show. Another beautiful day here in Honolulu. We're getting a little rain and clouds rolling off the mountains here. Today I have a guest, Mr. Chuck or Charles Toto, Tato. He's the executive director, legal counsel for the City Ethics Commission, the Honolulu Ethics Commission. Chuck, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Carol. Thank you for having me on.
Many people have called and they ask me and they want me to give them legal opinion as to what can a city worker take? Who is a lobbyist? Who has to register? And when, over the weeks and the months that I've been talking and the other things that I've been doing, I mean, inundated with calls or questions. So it was just by chance that I saw you that day and thought, what a perfect opportunity to ask you if you would come and join us and hear it straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak, as to what is it that is allowed, not allowed, and where are the gray areas, and something about the commission and some of the difficulties and some of the successes that you have. So if you could, tell us about, first of all, about yourself. I understand you went to McGregor School of Law, and you were a consumer advocate at one time. So tell us something about yourself.
That's right. I've been a lawyer for about 28 years now. And basically, the areas that I was in private practice, and then I went into government, which I really enjoyed because it allows you to spread your wings. You get to deal with the public interest and policy issues, so at first I was in consumer protection and then consumer advocacy. The difference there is consumer advocacy deals with utilities. And then after I left that, I went to private practice again and then back into government with the city in the current position.
I see. And what is your staff, the number of people?
It's the first two fingers on your hand. We have two people, and myself, and I have a legal assistant. And then I do have a contract with an attorney, Matt Viola. Mm-hmm. He works with us on an as-needed basis on some cases. So it's a small staff, and we basically have 10,000 city employees and appointees to deal with.
So if I can sum it up, you have this monumental mountain to shovel, and you have two shovels.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like to think of it as a mountain, but it's a lot of work.
Because a mountain would be better because with this, things are forever evolving.
That's right.
Situations and circumstances and political needs and just when there's money.
That's a really good point because one of the things that we deal with, we're reactive. People call us for advice. People send a complaint to us, and we react to that, and we respond. So it's difficult to anticipate exactly what's going to go on. We've seen in the newspapers Over the last few weeks, a number of issues, both dealing with ethics and elections, that have popped up that nobody could have anticipated. And so, yeah, we've got to jump into the fray there.
Yeah. So even if you anticipated them or were able to predict them, there are individuals that will sometimes ignore the rules or find that maybe the circumstance is suitable for them to commit an act. So even if you get things right this year with a new set of folks or what have you.
That's right. It's interesting. You know, if my point of view, I've always used this 99-1 rule. 99% of the people in city government want to do their jobs and they want to do them the right way. 1% are kind of act like scofflaws. They just figure that the city is there for them to have a job and to pay them money, and they can take advantage of various aspects. Now, I don't have any statistical proof of 99-1, but even with 100 people each year that give you trouble, that's a lot for two people to deal with.
Well, my experience with city workers has been one of a pleasant one. I would say 99% of them, and I do say that, in my personal experience, are honest, hardworking folks. And it's that 1% that will go to the park and park their truck and sit for 3 hours and sleep and then go back to their home, right?
That's right.
And that becomes a problem, right?
Yep.
So it makes it look bad for the others.
Well, you know, that's a really good point. Some people say, gee, you know, the problem with ethics, at least from a news media point of view, is that whenever something goes wrong, it makes it look like everybody's painted with that same brush.
Right.
It's not true. It is usually a singular act or a single person.
Mm-hmm.
And often, one of the most important things to remember, often it's city people turning in the culprit.
Right.
You know, the violator.
Right.
Because they realize that this is affecting them. You know, people want to go home with a good conscience at the end of the day and think that they're doing something helpful to the public.
Well, with me and a lot of these situations, which I've come to your office on many occasions, what strikes me is it's a more of a redemption for the workers. And that is, a lot of them preface their reports to me or their complaints in that they say, listen, I don't want to harm this guy or this lady. I really don't want, because this is an economy, it's a difficult time, people have little or no money, or hard times. I don't want to bring harm to this family or this person. But I'd like to see him stop because he's getting himself deeper and deeper into trouble.
Yeah. You know, that's, when I, you know, it's not just a matter of, you know, like a cop show or something, you know.
Right.
These are people, and sometimes they go off path. There are different ways to bring them on path, and but the coworkers are critical to that. In fact, one of the things I talk about in my ethics training is what I call the ethics frog. If you look, allow me to express that for a second. If you think about what happens when you throw a frog in a pot of boiling water, the frog jumps out immediately, isn't even burned, because their reaction is so fast.
Right.
It's easy from an ethics point of view for an individual to step away from a big, ugly ethics violation, you know, stealing money. Most people are not going to do that. They'll step away from it. They won't be involved. But if you put the same frog in the pot of water and it's just lukewarm and you turn the heat up low, the frog will stay there till it boils. And the lesson there is that it's the slow boil that usually gets to people. Right. They have to look at the ethics environment that they're in. What are the, you know, are you letting somebody get away with something that they shouldn't be getting away? Because often that'll get bigger and bigger and bigger. And after a few years, you're going to be the frog that boils. And so when I do management and supervisor training, I try to focus on them setting up their own environments and their sections, you know, to watch for that kind of thing.
Well, and I have spoken with others that say that, you know, I did this because it seemed to be the way of the agency, the organization.
Yeah.
It was tolerated, so I felt it was okay. And in fact, one gentleman told me that he engaged in unlawful activity. And this is not logical, but because he felt that he was a misfit, and that he felt that the others were doing it and doing it improperly or illegally, that if he did not join in, he would be scrutinized and, or ridiculed or ostracized.
Yeah, that's a very interesting way. There's a lot of peer pressure involved in those types of things, whether it's just to be quiet and look the other way, mm-hmm. or whether it's actually to get involved. But you're right. Every significant case, every serious violation that we deal with, the person says, but we've been doing it like that for years.
Right.
That's not an excuse to violate the law.
Right.
But it is a practical reason as to why they got involved in this. Whether or not it's true is another thing, but at least they kind of talk themselves into that.
Mm-hmm. We got a caller on the phone, and he wants to call in. Put him on. Jason, good morning. Are you there? You have a question for Mr. Tato? Hello, Jason. Anyway, that caller, you can call back, Jason, if you're... But now that we know that these problems exist and these climates exist within agencies, now you just regulate or oversee the issues within the city, not the state, correct?
That's right.
Do you have any relationship with Mr. Mulway, or how does your office work along with his?
Right. Well, first of all, the laws are very similar. We have the city laws, a few differences, but generally you'd probably say they're 90% the same. So often we look to the state because they have a lot more opinions that they've done over the years and so on. And Dan Mulway is a national asset that we're lucky to have here in Hawaii because he is one of the longest sitting mm-hmm. ethics attorneys in the country. So when I talk to Dan, it's just, you know, it's a great resource. So we work with them. Mm-hmm. We haven't done any, let's say, formal investigations together or anything like that. But the ability to bounce ideas back and forth, to get an idea as to why they may have taken a certain approach that we might be looking at taking a different path,
mm-hmm.
it's very helpful. So you know, it's somebody where we can talk to about conflicts of interest in specific cases or the problems with somebody using a public resource for their own benefit.
Mm-hmm.
What's your name? Anonymous.
Good morning, caller. We got an anonymous caller.
Yeah, how you doing, Mr. Cox?
I'm fine.
I got a question here for Chuck. What's his power over the executive management?
Okay, that's a very good question. And first of all, if I can say, we do take anonymous calls at my office, too. So if you have a complaint or a concern you want to talk to me about, you can get a hold of me at 768-7786 during regular city office hours. Now, your question was, what type of power do we have over the, basically, executive management of the city?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. For elected officers, the commission has the independent power to fine elected officers. And there will be a charter amendment on the ballot this fall that would extend that independent civil fine power for us to basically all exempt employees, which would be, if you will, the 350, 450 most important and influential decision makers in the city. Now, go ahead.
Would this cover harassment and a boss basically berating everybody?
It's a good question.
Where were derogatory comments?
Those types of issues are not within our jurisdiction, but there is a city office that deals with that, the Equal Employment Office. Our area focuses mostly on the misuse of public resources for someone's personal benefit. In other words, you know, taking the city vehicle and using it to run your own business, and conflicts of interest, where making a decision where you've got a personal interest that may be affected in making that decision. So those areas with that may be a hostile environment or workplace harassment, they go to the Equal Employment Office in the city.
Okay.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Chuck, we have all these difficulties and issues. What it boils down to is that we're looking at how this behavior impacts the taxpayer and the services that the taxpayer is receiving. And what do you do to train the workers or the employees or the supervisor of the executive branch. What is in place to do that?
Well, we have a mandatory ethics training program, and mandatory means it's required by law. For every supervisor, manager, elected officer, and board and commission member in city government, which means over the last 7 years, I think I've trained over 4,000 different managers, supervisors, and elected officers.
Mm-hmm.
What we emphasize, and we have our initial mandatory training, and now we're actually on refresher training. One of the things we emphasize directly is the tie between taxpayer money and carrying out the public's interest, the public trust. And that is really critical for the employees. Now, most employees know that, but what they don't know is, you know, they might have a conflict of interest and say, I'm a professional. That doesn't make, it's not going to make any difference to me that this is my brother-in-law. I can still treat him objectively and fairly. That's not the law. The law is, what would a reasonable taxpayer who knew all the circumstances think?
Mm-hmm.
And if a reasonable taxpayer would question their impartiality, then they should remove themselves from the matter. And a lot of ethics training, I find, is really, let's just give a bunch of examples. We work with examples in and out and allow people to get more and more comfortable with the fact that, hey, having a conflict of interest is, there's nothing wrong with that. We all have conflicts of interest from time to time. It's what you do with it.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a conflict, you just remove yourself. Let somebody else in the city government take care of that issue, but
right.
Not you.
Right. You recuse yourself wherever you're participating.
That's
in
right.
Meetings, declare any issues of conflicts
That's
of interest
right.
And what have
yeah,
you.
Yeah, because ultimately the public, you know, the reason we have ethics laws is so that the public can have confidence in the trustworthiness of government institutions and government people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we need to maintain a high level of training. And I'm happy to say we do. In fact, I think our program is probably the most thorough ethics training of any city in the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, back again, there's that mountain. You have to train them. You have two people.
That's right.
You have to train everybody in the city.
That's
then
right.
You have to respond to complaints and investigate them. What kind of budget do you have?
Well, we have a little bit over $200,000 a year. The council increased, well, I should say that actually this administration with the council approval had increased our budget by about 30% 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were looking at, just like you said, and I didn't use the mountain analogy, but there are a lot of different things we have to do, and I can't do all of them. So that's why a lot of our outside our cases go to the outside attorney, especially when my training time is way up. But we learn to balance things along.
Good morning, caller. You there?
Yeah, I got another. Chuck just brought up another question I asked. We have two new guys who started in environmental services, and they brought up a harassment charge against one of the executive managers there, and his two bosses are doing the investigation, and they're refusing to step down. Is that an ethical dilemma, since one of them was his boss's trainer for 6 years?
That's a good question. It may be. There may be a conflict of interest based on a personal relationship. Normally, the commission standard is that it has to be a very close personal or family relationship. But if I could use your point as kind of a, and certainly, you know, if you want to find out more about that, I'd say give me a call at the office and we can talk in real detail about it. But that brings up a great point, because sometimes people will say, well, you know, you've got the managers off in the departments looking at these issues, and then you got the ethics commission. Why bother with an ethics commission investigation? There's two very important reasons. The first one you just brought up. One is, or the Equal Employment Office in that particular case. One is because we don't come in with an agenda or a bias towards people. We don't know who these people are, so we're just looking for the facts. The second is you get a professional level of investigation. Managers, whether it's at ENV, that's Environmental Services Department, or any other department, are trained, and their major focus is to do their substantive work, not to investigate allegations of misconduct. My training is to investigate that. So there's a you know, two major factors as to why people might want to bring in the Ethics Commission. You're going to get an independent review, and one that's got a certain skill level that's above what the managers can provide.
So I can tell these two guys to give you a call then.
They can call me, and we can talk about whether it's something that my office should deal with, or the Equal Employment Office, or both.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Sure.
Thank you, caller. Chuck, speaking of the Environmental Services Department, over the past 2 weeks I've gotten some calls and was actually in tracking down to try and confirm this information before speaking about it publicly, that at the Environmental Services Department division within the city, at Sand Island Treatment Plant, apparently there's a many issues going on over there with them, employee conflicts and what have you. So I can direct them to you, and if you're out there, callers, some of them were anonymous, and some actually said they'd call again this coming week. There's issues where the company, the allegations, the company Synagro was pumping sulfur, hydrogen sulfide and methane unlawfully into pipes, condensation pipes. Now, I don't have all the details, but I did speak with OSHA, and they are, in fact, investigating. And I spoke with Health Department, and they indicated that the EPA had gone to query that. So it sounds like that's something. It spoke about the supervisors had some kind of conflict with Synagro. They mentioned golfing and that this. So what I'll do, it's so varied. I think what I'll do is next time I'll have them to call your office, because they indicated that there were possible issues of the supervisor were taking golfing trips or occasion, or providing funding to the supervisor's family, a child's soccer team. That I don't know how to piece all of that together, but should they call you?
Sure, definitely. Because, and that's a great example of what happens sometimes. You know, in Hawaii, we have many cultures that do gift giving.
Right.
You know, and to me, tokens of aloha are gifts that where you do not expect something back.
Right.
But because on the ethics side, people may act differently towards somebody who's given them a gift. Mm-hmm. We have to be careful about those. Tokens of aloha, you know, food gifts, small items like that are usually not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But you can see in this situation that there may be a conflict of interest. Let's just take hypothetically that somebody's getting golf outings. We have a gift cap law in Hawaii, or in Honolulu, which means if you receive more than $200 in gifts in 1 year from one source, then it's an automatic violation. You could go golfing a few times and easily go over that $200, okay?
Right.
Or if it's below $200, it doesn't mean that it's automatically okay, because if somebody gives me something that's worth $150, I may very well start picking up their phone call when I wouldn't somebody else's.
Right.
These are very subtle issues, but the ethics law does provide for some caution there. And then, of course, you can see how these things may, obviously OSHA is a better office to go to about the hydrogen sulfide problem than would my office be. We don't have any skills in that area. But on the other hand, if part of the problem is, well, you know, they're very close to, one of the contractors for the city, that's something that we'd look into.
Well, I'm astounded that all you have is about $200,000 to watch. There's that little shovel shoveling that mountain. See, it's all relevant, I believe. I just can't imagine that in your capacity, your responsibilities, that all you have is about two people and $200,000. I've seen functions. Just recently, we had a function provided by the Environmental Services Division. And that in itself would have cost at least $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 for one event, minimum.
Yeah, you know, maybe I've been in government too long, but there's a chicken and egg problem in government budgeting, and every person who works for government is going to know what I'm talking about. Do you build up your office to take care of the load of work that you think you would get if you were Or do you wait till you get that load of work and then ask to build up your office? Well, usually in government, the budgeting comes after the demand, the increase in budget, because you know, there are so many people rightfully asking, well, why do you need to have that much money? So we did get a significant increase, and our budget will hopefully go up as more, as we get more and more calls, as we do more complaints, more training, we try to get more bills passed and so on. We will grow as we need.
But the, but there is a danger in that approach, because I might be discouraged in calling you if I call you today and you don't have the budget or the manpower to address my issues or investigate. Then I'm not calling you again, and the word's going to be disseminated that don't bother calling that agency because they're not going to do anything, even though you would do something, but you don't have the resources. So there's a double-edged sword there, right?
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
And it's crippling. But in this situation, this is a living, viable entity, the city government, with many people with a variety of interests and many others outnumbering them that want to influence their powers and their authority. So $200,000, I believe, is merely children's change. And I think that the public, if you're listening out there, whenever there's an opportunity to increase Mr. Toto's budget or come this fiscal year or whatever, the legislators should, the city legislators should give you more money.
Yeah.
Without asking, because it's just too many varieties of behavior, of unlawful behaviors. Oh, just the training in itself looked like it would to do adequately. You should have a training individual to allow you to adhere and stick to the issues of complaints.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. One of the things that I love about training is because, you know, you're dealing with these honest folks. They'll tell you what the issues are. What about the, I mean, I must get 10 to 20 questions about what if, and you know, these are the what ifs that have probably happened to them over the years. So that's very useful in my job, but you're absolutely right. We have never done, for instance, a random audit of, let's say, the financial disclosure statements that are filed by 450 of the city's most powerful people.
Right.
You know, and those types of things. So again, we just stay in this reactive mode. You're right, we're susceptible to the people saying, you know, I gave it to them, they didn't have enough money to do a thorough job, or they didn't have enough money, so it took a year before it got, you know, was done, or whatever. And you're right, one unsatisfied customer means you're probably going to lose a whole lot of business. And so we've got to look at ways to get past that.
And it's important, because usually when there is one individual that is complaining to your office or even calling me up, I know factually there's been at least five or six of them sitting in the office just sick and tired of being sick and tired of what was going on. And so at least there's five individuals within each branch or each division that knows of that situation. And others watch it. And so the message sent, if it goes unaddressed, the message sent to the lower-ranking people is that I'm the boss and I can get away with anything.
That's right.
And so that's demoralizing. And so they may not take an act of committing crimes, the lower ranking people. They just give the I don't care or I don't care.
Yeah. No, it's unfortunate. And that is a problem that we need to deal with. If we could be more active, more out there. We do a survey, and I've got about 1,000 surveys now when we do training. At the end of it, I asked a lot of different questions on a survey sheet, and one of those is, what can the Ethics Commission do to improve ethics environment in the city? And one is to train not just the supervisors and above. They may set the tone, but a lot of supervisors will look, you know, the other way. They'll turn a blind eye to the fact that there are people under them getting away with murder.
Right.
And so they say, go train everybody. And that's, you're right, I can't do that physically. So we'll, but I think if nothing else, we'll at least be able to put together a video. The sexual harassment training is done for everybody in the city, and they put together videos with questions and so on. And it may not be the, you know, the soup to nuts training that you'd love to give, but on the other hand, it is, it gets the issues aired, and that's what you need to do, so that people know, oh, that's not right. I didn't think it was right, but I didn't know, or I didn't know who to talk to.
Right. Well, I got one other point, and then we're going to take a break. But if a city worker were to call your office, how or what protection does your office afford that complainant for against retaliation? Could you?
Sure. First of all, when somebody calls our office, whether they want to be anonymous or not, if they call and give a name or they submit a complaint in writing, the city law requires that we not disclose the name of that person. Okay, so that's your first protection. Mm-hmm. The other protections are that should it be known that you are the complainant, the complaint's protected by the federal and state anti-retaliation or the whistleblower laws. Mm-hmm. And those help prevent retaliation in the workplace. Now, I'm not so naive as to think that the law is going to prevent somebody who wants to retaliate from retaliating.
Right.
And so whoever is going to be a whistleblower needs to be very cautious about what they're going to blow the whistle on. Mm-hmm. And they need to think, you know, kind of do a little soul searching about that. But the law protects them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we see every few, well, maybe a couple of three times a year, we'll see a retaliation case that's gone to the courts against the city, and sometimes they come out with high judgments, mm-hmm. or high settlements for the plaintiff. But that is not it still can rock your life for 3 or 4 years. So
mm-hmm.
If people are worried about this, one of the things to do, which is very interesting, you mentioned usually there is a bunch of people in the office who don't mm-hmm. like what's going on but don't really feel strong enough to, you know, blow the whistle.
Right.
But when I get a complaint like that, one of the first things I do is go interview everybody in the group. And you'll often, as you said, the rest of the group will go, yeah, that's what's going on.
Right.
And when that happens, you usually have a pretty strong case. And the stronger the case, the less likely the retaliation, I think.
Right. You're listening to the Carol Cox Show. My guest is Mr. Chuck Tato from the Honolulu City Ethics Commission. If you want to listen to this later, go to carolcox.com. That's CarolCox.com. We're going to take a break and be right back.
Okay. Fish lovers of Hawaii, listen up, please, because there's some good news and some bad news. The bad news is that the state and federal governments have closed the main Hawaiian Islands fisheries for 7 bottom fish species. This closure affects the so-called Deep Seven, meaning Opakapaka, Kalikali, Onaga, Ehu, Jindai, Sea Bass, and Lehi. So from now until September 1st, you can't catch them, eat them, give them away, or even have one on your boat. The good news is that the Deep Seven fisheries of the northwestern Hawaiian Islands are loaded with fish and are open year-round. Not too many boats are allowed to fish the northwest these days, but you can ask your favorite fish store or restaurant to keep an eye out for you when their catches do arrive at the fish auction. So good luck and bon appetit.
Welcome back to the Carol Cox Show. Again, my guest is Mr. Chuck Tato from the City Honolulu Ethics Commission. Again, Chuck, thank you. Picking up where you left off.
Yeah, there are a couple of real important points I want to make. First of all, ask me. If you don't feel like calling this morning or if you have a friend and you talk about things, call my office. Again, 768-7786 is my direct phone number. You'll get me or my voicemail. The other thing that we have a good website. It's www.honolulu.gov/ethics. And you can also get our email address off of there. A lot of people have questions, and there's no harm. I mean, that's what I'm there for. One of the things that we do, we've talked about training, we've talked about investigating, but we also give advice to people, whether they're in the city or in the public, that want to ask, is this legal? Is this okay for them to do? Because we don't want people to violate the ethics laws, so if we can ask people, you know, we can find out up front from city employees what they'd like to do and tell them, yeah, it's okay, or no, it's not okay. That's what we'd like. That's where we focus a lot of our work.
So that's why your title is Executive Director, Legal Counsel, right?
That's right.
You're giving, that's why it's clear. So before getting into trouble, becoming that frog in the pot.
That's right.
Call in, yeah. See.
And we get 400 to 500 requests a year for advice. We get about 50 complaints, well, about 40 that we actually investigate, mm-hmm. complaints that we look at a year. And I hear we have a caller.
Yeah. Caller, John, you there?
Yes, good morning. I've been listening to your program for maybe about the last 20, 30 minutes.
Okay.
And, Chuck, everything you say so far I've agreed with, but I know you probably know that there's more departments. Certain departments have more problems than other departments.
That's right.
And I come from one that I think has a lot of problems, and it's where you have upper management blatantly in positions that you would have authority to command the respect and the honesty and integrity. We have people in top positions lying outright, and because of their positions, people are to respect their lies. In other words, if it's your word against mine, he's in a higher position. And when there's that one-on-one case, then his word is taken over another person's word.
That may happen from time to time. And you're right. Sometimes the toughest cases for me to deal with are the, if you don't mind me putting it this way, the he said, she said. Who is the commission to believe?
Correct.
Yeah.
But what my question then would come is all the training is not going to prevent that from happening, because I know that there is a lot of people who have tried stepping up. There's no secrecy once a complaint goes in. Even if it goes to your department and you guys don't say something, once the investigation starts and upper management feels or thinks they know who it is, the same way that you find out what is true, the same way management finds out who or narrows down who the mole or who the person that is leaking information. I look at it that would be to the best interest of the city and county to actually, for maybe a 4 or 5 year period, give you money and allow you to privatize an investigation that you work under to take care of the major departments that are having a lot of problems. And the reason I say that is I have sat and been involved in investigations where the people investigating me in higher management go out to drink beers with the same people they're investigating. They are good friends with them, and they still allow investigations to go through. And their bottom line is, if you don't like it, grieve it. And I think you get a lot of calls in this regard.
Yes, I do.
I would like to see that the investigations get taken out of the hands of the departments and or divisions, however do we want to break it down, to where an honest investigation can take place. And I believe you will have more people stepping forward, because you will get to the truth easier. And these people who are on top that are being blatantly negligent in the way they treat people and the lies that they come up with are going to be put in a corner where now it's going to be obvious. Right now, I know a lot of people, even myself, if they know who I'm calling in, going to get some retaliation. But I'm at the point where I'm sick of this. I'm really tired. I've been an employee there over 20 years, and I thought that as I move up management rank, that I would be able to make a difference. I realize that I'm playing ball with everybody there because I'm going to do things honestly. And that's something that I don't see integrity with the upper management. And I'm not saying it's everyone, but there's a large majority of it that for so many years they've been getting away with so many things and starts with little things and has built up to bigger things. And I don't think they're obvious to what they're doing at this point.
Okay, caller. Chuck, I can give some testimony to that. There was one particular case you did and gave a ruling, a positive ruling and what have you. But the Environmental Services Division, for example, took that case, and when I called and complained to them, they initiated the investigation instead of standing back and concerned with conflict. This is what they did. They initiated an investigation internally, not to find out if the individual was wrong in doing what he was accused of doing, but to, quote, find the rat.
That's obviously the wrong approach.
Yeah,
you're going. That's 180 degrees from the direction it should go. Now, I don't know about finding the rat. That's not something I'm familiar with.
Well, you wouldn't do that, but...
But the whole... You know, the caller's got some really good points. And if... And maybe that is an option. One of the things that there are a number of us in city government that are trying to work towards is to get an idea as to, okay, how many fraud and waste, abuse, ethics violations do we have in city government?
Right.
I know how many in my office, but nobody knows how many are in the departments. That's just an example that we need to coordinate what goes on. If you will, there's a model called an inspector general model
right. That
could be used where whenever there's a complaint, whether it's harassment, sexual discrimination, an ethics issue, it can go into an investigative mode where people are covering. So the notion is to get more coordination. And part of that, as the caller said, is to have a process that kicks the allegations out of the department.
Right.
And that can be done. I think people could do it now, either by going to my office or by going to the Equal Employment Office in the regard that what they handle.
Right.
And saying, look, I don't think I'm going to get a fair shake here because these guys are buddies for 30 years or whatever the reasons
are.
Right. So it may be worthwhile to take that approach. Don't just sit back and say, well, you know, they're going to believe him and not me.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy doing the investigation is the good friend of the guy I filed a complaint on.
Right. I think we have another caller. Steve, are you there for Mr. Toto?
Just a quick question. I listened to the callers. Apparently, ethics violations and shenanigans are rampant in city government. For example, in the last 3 months, how many cases were brought to you approximately, and how many were adjudicated to solve the problem, or there were punitive results? The problem was satisfactorily resolved. And one problem I see in all of this is that the overall broad coverage of the privacy law is so secretive that nothing can be put out regarding any punitive damage adjudication to any violator. It cannot be publicized. Is that correct?
You've got... I'm amazed by your callers because they know the system inside and out. That is a problem. Let me start with what you mentioned last, the privacy law. You know, there's always a balance between letting the public know who's doing what, who of their government authorities are, what they're doing, and whether they're doing it lawfully versus people's privacy. Now, with the collective bargaining unit employees, their specific discipline is private, except in very rare circumstances. And right now, we're in the process of trying to find out from the Office of Information Practices that deals in interpreting the privacy law just what we can tell the public about what their either elected or appointed officers are doing. So that is it is difficult to get information out to the public on that. A lot of the times it's going to be filtered, and we can't even identify the department, for instance. The in the last 3 months, you raised questions about, well, what's been going on in the last 3 months. It takes time. One of the things that our office does, and where this is not the most efficient approach, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that we can assess fines for serious misconduct, but most of the time what we do is investigate, and then the report will come from the commission. I'll present a case, the case to the commission. They'll come out with a report that then goes to what we call the appointing authority, like it would be the director of a department where an employee works, or the mayor if it's a board or commission member. And then that appointing authority has the sole province to do what they will do in terms of penalty or discipline. The commission can recommend discipline. We've had cases where we've recommended discipline where the appointing authority has said no. Most of the time, the great majority of times, they'll follow suit with what we suggest because our report is very thorough and, as I say, independent. But there are problems there because we're not, you know, we're in this odd situation. We're an independent agency, but yet the other agencies don't necessarily have to listen to us.
Okay, Steve, thank you for calling. Did that, any other question? Okay, it's gone. But thanks again, Steve, for calling. What neighborhood boards, do you regulate them or oversee them?
We do not.
Commissions?
Yeah. When we talk about boards and commissions, we're talking about the planning commission, the fire commission, the police commission, and so on, those types. But the neighborhood boards are a slightly different animal. Mm-hmm. And we've, Corporation Council has given us an opinion that that's not within our jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So my understanding is that they try to, the neighborhood commission itself can handle complaints about neighborhood board members.
Right.
And they do.
Now, here's an interesting twist that have always bothered me. I've heard of that opinion, but you see, within administrations, mayoral administrations, even this administration, they purposely and strategically place some of their employees with the specific intent to be there, in a sense, representing. So how do they flip on a switch, you know, to say, well, now I'm no longer working for the mayor, I'm no longer working for the city council person, I'm now a neighborhood board member, but I'm going to sit here and vote on and talk about issues that the city councilman or the mayor or someone like that, shouldn't that be revisited? Because it seems to be a very fragile, delicate situation there.
You know, as it's ripe for conflict of interest, as you point out, and I don't know how you flip that switch.
Right.
And it's not for me to tell the neighborhood commission what to look at. But
right. But that's the dilemma you find yourself in. Polka is on the line. Polka, are you there?
Yes, aloha.
Aloha.
I have one question, and that is, in an investigation, what is a standard of proof that the investigator will use to determine whether or not the allegations are supported or not? And does the standard of proof change depending on the accusation, being a sexual harassment accusation or some other accusation? That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. I can't really respond about the sexual harassment standard of proof because that's not in my culiana. But the regarding the ethics issues or fraud, waste, abuse, if it's an administrative proceeding, which is what ours are, we just look at preponderance of the evidence. Now, that's a fancy lawyer's phrase. For what it means is there's more evidence than not that shows that the person committed the violation. You might think about it this way. You know, if it's a criminal case, we know that you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. That's pretty hard to do sometimes. And it's sometimes we take cases from HPD or the prosecutors where they don't think they can prove that. But we would be able to at our level. So it's a level of proof that I don't have a problem with because, you know, you certainly want to make sure that the justice is done. That's the main thing.
Okay, we have another caller for you, Chuck. Bob, are you there?
Yeah, hey, Chuck.
Hi.
Quick question. We have guys get investigated for 7, 8, 9 months. Nothing gets done.
or comes back and they say, oh, it passed the investigation time and investigation is dropped. And these guys are out of work for, you know, a year, 2 years, getting paid. And when they come back to work, they get a two-week suspension. I mean, does that sound right to you?
Well, I'll tell you, no. Having a slow review period is something we've been trying to get away from because I would be very frank with you. 3 or 4 years ago, our backlog was up to 5 years for the slowest case that we dealt with. Now it's down to 2 years for one case, and soon we will be having all of our cases done in about 6 months.
Is that your office, or is that...
That's my office, though, not the...
I'm talking about department investigations.
Yeah, the department investigations can take a long time. Part of that is because they may not have the most skilled people doing it. Or a lot of times, you know, these people aren't investigators. They're managers. They've got a whole set of work to do, and sometimes they're busy as heck doing it. So there are a lot of reasons why things slow down there, and also it may very well be that they don't want to get to the result. So, no, it doesn't sound appropriate to me. I think the city needs to take a look at kind of revamping. If there are issues, let's get them up front, deal with them promptly and fairly, and resolve them and move on. It's the times where they go on for a year or two or nothing is done that really ruins morale and really festers.
Okay. You have another caller there. Bob, are you there? Another Bob. Hello, Bob.
Yes, I am, sir.
Go ahead. You have a question for Mr. Tata.
Well, I just didn't make a comment on what you said, like the case is taking so long, and you know what I mean? If anything takes 5 years, though, you might as well forget about it because people die and go away and whatever, you know what I mean? I see your job is pretty tough, but I'd like to relate back to the Neighborhood Board Commission. You know, I served on the Neighborhood Board, and one of the main problems on the Neighborhood Board is the entrenchment. They don't have a term limit, so when people get in there 10, 15 years and stuff like that, it's just... all for, you know, a certain click, like they get in these neighborhood boards. And, and the commission is even part of the problem. You know what I mean? Because they're part of the click, too, as far as I'm concerned. So the neighborhood boards need to be revisited and to have a different auspices of somebody, you know, seeing what they're doing and what's going on behind the scenes.
Okay.
Like I said, I was on the board, and, you know, I was really, literally, physically attacked by people on the board because of, you know, my views and pointing out this hypocrisy and, you know, hypocritical, you know, stuff that they were doing.
Okay.
So I think the neighborhood boards really need to be overlooked by you know, somebody different than the commission because it's, with the city, it just seems like it's not right because neighborhood board is not governed. You know what I mean?
Okay, caller.
You said you have no dealings with them, but do you have any opinion on neighborhood boards or the way they're run now?
Okay, caller, he does not regulate the neighborhood boards, but we will be doing a show on neighborhood boards coming in the coming weeks. So please hold your thoughts and do call in, and I'd love to... Okay, we're running down short of time here, but again, give us a call back, and I'll announce when we're going to have this. But Chuck, thank you, and I hope you'll join us again. As you can see, the number of callers, the number of questions, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me, and I'd love to come back.
Okay, and what I'll say to everybody out there is that we are doing this solely because we think taxpayers deserve a little better services, and that's not to say Mr. Tato's office is not serving us well. We need to put the resources and the monies and support legislation that is introduced by him. For the city council people out there, you need ethics. We need you to draw bills that govern yourselves and all, and we need the workers to be governed. So it's all about the taxpayer and the tax dollar. So thank you. This is the Carol Cox Show. And again, Chuck, thank you. And anytime you want to come back, just give us a call. It's open mic for you.
I'll be here.
Thank you.
Fish lovers of Hawaii, listen up, please, because there's some good news and some bad news. The bad news is that the state and federal governments have closed the main Hawaiian Islands fisheries for 7 bottom fish species. This closure affects the so-called Deep Seven, meaning Opakapaka, Kalikali, Onaga, Ehu, Jindai, Seabass, and Lehi. So from now until September 1st, you can't catch them, eat them, give them away, or even have one on your boat. The good news is that the Deep Seven fisheries of the northwestern Hawaiian Islands are loaded with fish and are open year-round. Not too many boats are allowed to fish the northwest these days, but you can ask your favorite fish store or restaurant to keep an eye out for you when their catches do arrive at the fish auction. So good luck and bon appetit.
This is KWAI Honolulu.